Big John howled. They forced me. They made me drink. The next blow knocked him off his feet. He kept screaming, although now the words were no longer coherent. And the leathers cracked on his yellow skin, the wheels rising in thick, shiny ridges and turning purple-red as ripe great skins. The sharp buckle shredded his shirt as though it had been torn off him by a lion's claws, and the sand clotted his blood into wet balls as it dribbled into the river bed. He stopped screaming at last, and Lothar stood back, panting, and wiped the wet red leather thongs on a saddlecloth, and looked at the faces of his men. The beating had been for them as much as for the man curled at his feet. They were wild dogs, and they understood only strength, respected only cruelty. Hendrik spoke for them all. He was paid a fair price. Shall I finish him? No. Leave a horse for him. Lothar turned away. When he comes round, he can follow us, or he can go to hell where he belongs. He swung up into the saddle of his own mount and avoided his son's stricken eyes as he raised his voice. All right, we're moving out. He rode with long stirrups in the Boer fashion, slouched down comfortably in the saddle, and Hendrik pushed his mount up on one side of him and Manfred on the other. Lothar felt elated. The adrenaline of violence was like a drug in his blood still, and the open desert lay ahead of him. With the taking of the horses, he had crossed the frontier of the law. He was an outlaw once again, free of society's restraint, and he felt his spirit towering on high like a hunting falcon. By God, I'd almost forgotten what it was like to have a rifle in my hand and a good horse between my legs. We are men once again, Hendrik agreed, and leaned across to embrace Manfred. You too. Your father was your age when he and I first rode out to war. We're going to war again. You are a man as he was. And Manfred forgot the spectacle he had just witnessed, and swelled with pride at being counted in this company. He sat up straight in the saddle and lifted his chin. Lothar turned his face into the northeast, towards the hinterland where the vast Kalahari brooded, and led them away. That night, while they were camped in a deep gorge which shielded the light of their small fire, the sentinel roused them with a low whistle. They rolled out of their blankets, snatched up their rifles, and slipped away into the darkness. The horses stirred and whickered, and then Pig John rode in out of the darkness and dismounted. He stood wretchedly by the fire, his face swollen and discoloured with bruises like a cur dog expecting to be driven away. The others came out of the shadows, and without looking at him or otherwise acknowledging his existence, climbed back into their blankets. Sleep on the other side of the fire from me, Lothar told him harshly. You stink of brandy. And Pig John wriggled with relief and gratification that he had been accepted back into the band. In the dawn, they mounted again and rode on into the wide, hot emptiness of the desert. The road out to Harney Mine was probably one of the most rugged in southwest Africa, and every time she negotiated it, Santaine promised herself, we must really do something about having it repaired. Then Dr. Twentyman Jones would give her an estimate of the cost of resurfacing hundreds of miles of desert track, and of erecting bridges over the river courses and consolidating the passes through the hills, and Santaine's good, frugal sense would reassert itself. After all, it only takes 3 days, and I seldom have to drive it more than 3 times a year, and it is really quite an adventure. The telegraph line that had connected the mine to Windhoek had been expensive enough. After an estimate of £50, it had finally cost her £100 for every single mile. And she still felt resentment every time she looked at that endless line of poles strung together with gleaming copper wire that ran beside the track. Apart from the cost, it spoiled the view, detracting from the feeling of wildness and isolation which she so treasured when she was out in the Kalahari. She remembered with a twinge of nostalgia how they had slept on the ground and carried their water in the first years. Now there were regular stages at each night's stop, thatched rondavels and windmills to raise water from the deep bores, servants living permanently at each station to service the rest houses, providing meals and hot baths and a log fire in the hearth on those crisp, frosty nights of the Kalahari winter. Even paraffin refrigerators, manufacturing heavenly ice for the sundowner whiskey in the fierce summer heat. The traffic on the road was heavy. The regular convoy under Gerhard Fiery, carrying out fuel and stores, had cut deep ruts in the soft earth and churned up the crossings in the dried riverbeds. And worst of all, the gauge of the tyres of the big Ford trucks was wider than that of the yellow Daimler, so that she had to drive with one wheel in the rut and the other bouncing and jolting over the uneven middle ridge. Added to all this, it was high summer, and the heat was crushing. The metal of the Daimler's coachwork could raise blisters on the skin, and they were forced to halt regularly when the water in the radiator boiled and blew a singeing plume of steam high in the air. The very heavens seemed to quiver with blue fire, and the far desert horizons were washed away by the shimmering glassy whirlpools of heat mirage. If only they could make a machine small enough to cool the air in the Daimler, she thought, like the one in the railway coach. And then she burst out laughing. Tien! I must be getting soft! She remembered how, with two old bushmen who had rescued her, she had travelled on foot through the terrible dune country of the Namib, and they had been forced to cover their bodies with a plaster of sand and their own urine to survive the monstrous heat of the desert noons. "Why are you laughing, Mater?" Shasta demanded. "Oh, just something that happened long ago, before you were born." "Tell me. Oh, please tell me." He seemed unaffected by the heat and the dust and the merciless jolting of the chassis. "But then why should he be?" She smiled at him. This was where he was born. He too is a creature of the desert. Shasta took her smile for acquiescence. Come on, Mater, tell me the story. Pourquoi pas? Why not? And she told him, and watched the shock in his expression. Your own pee-pee? He was aghast. That surprises you, she mocked him. Then let me tell you what we did when the water in our ostrich egg bottles was finished. Old Oa, the bushman hunter, killed a Gemsbok bull with his poisoned arrow, and we took out the first stomach, the rumen, and we squeezed out the liquid from the undigested contents, and we drank that. It kept us going just long enough to reach the sip wells. Mater! That's right, Sherry. I drink champagne when I can, but I'll drink whatever keeps me alive when I have to. She was silent while he considered that, and she glanced at his face and saw the revulsion turn to respect. What would you have done, Sherry? Drunk it or died? She asked, to make sure the lesson was learned. I would have drunk, he answered without hesitation. And then, with affectionate pride, "You know, Mater, you really are a crackerjack." It was his ultimate accolade. "Look!" She pointed ahead to where the lion-coloured plain, its far limits lost in the curtains of mirage, seemed to be covered with a gauzy cinnamon-coloured veil of thin smoke. Sontaine pulled the Daimler off the track, and they climbed out onto the running board for a better view. Springbok, the first we have seen on this trip. The beautiful gazelle were moving steadily across the flats, all in the same direction. There must be tens of thousands. The springbok were elegant little animals with long, delicate legs and lyre-shaped horns. They are migrating into the north, Sontaine told him. There must have been good rains up there, and they are moving to the water. Suddenly, the nearest gazelles took fright at their presence and began the peculiar alarm display that the Boers called pronking. They arched their backs and bowed their long necks until their muzzles touched their forehooves, and they bounced on stiff legs, flying high and lightly into the shimmering hot air, while from the fold of skin along their backs they flashed a flowing white crest of hair. This alarm behaviour was infectious, and soon thousands of gazelle were bounding across the plain like a flock of birds. Sontaine jumped down from the running board and mimicked them, forking the fingers of one hand over her head as horns, and with the fingers of the other showing the crest hair down her back. She did it so skillfully that Chassa hooted with laughter and clapped his hands. "Bully for you, mater!" He jumped down and joined her, and they pranced in a circle until they were weak with laughter and exertion. Then they leaned against the Daimler and clung to each other for support. "Old Oa taught me that," Sontaine gasped. "He could imitate every animal of the veldt." When they drove on, she let Chassa take the wheel, for the crossing of the plain was one of the easier stretches of the journey, and he drove well. She lay back in the corner of her seat, and after a while, Chassa broke the silence. "When we are alone, you are so different." He searched for the words. "You are such jolly good fun. I wish we could just be like this forever." "Anything you do too long becomes a bore," she told him gently. "The trick is to do it all, not just one thing. This is good fun, but tomorrow we will be at the mine and there will be another type of excitement for us to experience. And after that, there will be something else. We'll do it all, and we will wring from each moment the last drop it has to offer." 20-man Jones had gone ahead to the mine, while Sontaine stayed on for 3 days in Windhoek to go over the paperwork with Abraham Abrahams. So he had alerted the servants at the rest houses as he passed through. When they reached the last stage that evening, the bath water was so hot that even Sontaine, who enjoyed her bath at the correct temperature for boiling lobster, was forced to add cold before she could bear it. The champagne was that marvellous 1928 Krug, pale and chilled to the temperature she preferred, just low enough to frost the bottle. And though there was ice, she would not allow the barbaric habit of standing the bottle in a bucket of it. Cold feet, hot head. Bad combination for both men and wine, her father had taught her. As always, she drank only a single glass from the bottle, and afterwards there was the cold collation that Twentyman Jones had provided for her and stored in the paraffin refrigerator, fare suitable for this heat, and which he knew she enjoyed. Rock lobster from the green Benguela current, with rich white flesh curled in their spiny red tails, and salad vegetables grown in the cooler highlands of Windhoek. Lettuce crackling crisp, tomatoes crimson ripe, and pungent onions purple-tinted. Then, as the final treat, wild truffles gleaned from the surrounding desert by the tame bushman who tended the milk herd. She ate them raw, and the salty fungus taste was the taste of Kalahari. They left again, in the pitch darkness before dawn, and at sunrise they stopped and brewed coffee on a fire of camel thorn branches. The grainy red wood burned with an intense blue flame and gave to the coffee a peculiar and delicious aroma. They ate the picnic breakfast that the rest house cook had provided and washed it down with the smoky coffee and watched the sunrise smearing the sky and desert with bronze and gilding it with gold leaf. As they went on, so the sun rose higher and drained the land of colour, washing it with its silver-white bleach. "Stop here," Santayne ordered suddenly, and when they climbed up onto the roof of the Daimler and stared ahead, Chasseur was puzzled. "What is it, Mater?" "Don't you see it, chérie?" she pointed. "There, above the horizon." It floated in the sky, indistinct and ethereal. "It's standing in the sky," Chasseur exclaimed, discerning it at last. "The mountain that floats in the sky," Santayne murmured. Each time she saw it like this, the wonder of it was still as fresh and enchanting as the first time. "The place of all life." She gave the hills their bushman name. As they drove on, so the shape of the hills hardened, becoming a sheer rock palisade, below which were spread the open Mopane forests. In places the cliffs were split and riven with gullies and gorges. In others they were solid and tall and daubed with bright lichens, sulphur yellow and green and orange. The Harney Mine was nestled beneath one of these sheer expanses of rock, and the buildings seemed insignificant and incongruous in this place. Santayne's brief to Twentyman Jones had been to make them as unobtrusive as possible, without, of course, affecting the productivity of the workings. But there was a limit to just how far he had been able to follow her instructions. The fenced compounds of the black workers and the weathering grounds for the blue diamondiferous earth were extensive, while the steel tower and elevator of the washing gear stuck up high as the derrick of an oil rig. However, the worst depredation had been caused by the appetite of the steam boiler, hungry as some infernal Baal for cordwood. The forest along the foot of the hills had been cut down to satisfy it, and the second growth had formed a straggly, unsightly thicket in place of the tall, grey-barked timber. Twentyman Jones was waiting for them as they climbed out of the dusty Daimler in front of the thatched administration building. "Good trip, Mrs. Courtney?" he asked, lugubrious with pleasure. "You'll want to rest and clean up, I expect." "You know better than that, Dr. Twentyman Jones. Let's get down to work." And Santayne led the way down the wide veranda to her own office. "Sit beside me," she ordered Chasseur, as she took her seat at the stinkwood desk. They began with the recovery reports, then went on to the cost schedules, and as Chasseur struggled to keep up with the quick calling and discussion of figures, he wondered how his mother could change so swiftly from the girl companion who had hopped around in imitation of a springbok only the previous day. "Chasseur, what did we establish was the cost per carat if we averaged 23 carats per load?" She fired the question at Chasseur suddenly, and when he muffed it, she frowned. "This isn't the time for dreams." And she turned her shoulder to him to emphasize the rebuke. "Very well, Dr. Twentyman Jones, we have avoided the unpleasant long enough. Let us consider what economies we have to institute to meet the quota cut and still keep the Harney Mine working and turning a profit." It was dusk before Santayne broke off and stood up. "We'll pick it up from there tomorrow." She stretched like a cat and then led them on to the wide veranda. "Chasseur will be working for you as we agreed. I think he should begin on the haulage." "I was about to suggest it, ma'am." "What time do you want me?" Chasseur asked. The shift comes on at 5 a.m., but I expect Master Chasseur will want to come on later. Twentyman Jones glanced at Santaine. It was, of course, a challenge and a test, and she remained silent, waiting for Chasseur to make the decision on his own account. She saw him struggling with himself. He was at that stage of growth when sleep is a drug, and rising in the morning a brutal penance. "I'll be at the main haulage at 4:30, sir," he said, and Santaine relaxed and took his arm. "Then it had best be an early night," she said. She turned the Daimler into the avenue of small iron-roofed cottages, which housed the white shift bosses and artisans and their families. The orders of society were strictly observed on the Harney mine. It was a microcosm of the young nation. The black labourers lived in the fenced and guarded compounds where whitewashed buildings resembled rows of stables. There were separate, more elaborate quarters for the black boss boys who were allowed to have their families living with them. The white artisans and shift bosses were housed in the avenues laid out at the foot of the hills, while the management lived up the slopes, each building larger and the lawns around it more extensive, the higher it was sited. As they turned at the edge of the avenues, there was a girl sitting on the stoop of the last cottage, and she stuck her tongue out at Chasseur as the Daimler passed. It was almost a year since Chasseur had last seen her, and nature had wrought wondrous changes in her during that time. Her feet were still bare and dirty to the ankles, and her curls were still wind-tousled and sun-streaked. But the faded cotton of her blouse was now so tight that it constricted her blossoming breasts. They were forced upwards and bulged out over the top in a deep cleavage, and Chasseur wriggled in the seat as he realized that the twin red-brown coin-shaped marks on the blouse, though they looked like stains, were in fact showing through the thin cloth from beneath. Her legs had grown longer, her knees were no longer knobbly, and they shaded from coffee-brown at the ankles to smooth cream on the inside of her thighs. She sat on the edge of the veranda with her knees apart and her skirts pulled high and rucked up between her legs. As Chasseur's gaze dropped, she let her knees fall a little further open. Her nose was snubbed and sprinkled with freckles, and she wrinkled it as she grinned. It was a sly, cheeky grin, and her tongue was bright pink between white teeth. Guiltily, Chasseur jerked his eyes away and stared ahead through the windshield. But he remembered vividly every last detail of those forbidden minutes behind the pump house, and the heat rose in his cheeks. He could not help glancing at his mother. She was looking ahead at the road and had not noticed. He felt relief until she murmured, "She is a common little hussy, ogling everything in pants. Her father is one of the men we are retrenching. We'll be rid of her before she causes real trouble for us and herself." He should have known she had not missed that brief exchange. She saw everything, he thought. And then he felt the impact of her words. The girl was being sent away, and he was surprised by his feeling of deprivation. It was a physical ache in the floor of his stomach. "What will happen to them, Mater?" he asked softly. "I mean, the people we are firing." While he had listened to his mother and Twentyman Jones discussing the retrenchments, he had thought of them merely as numbers. But with that glimpse of the girl, they had become flesh and blood. He remembered his adversary, the blonde boy, and the little girl that he had seen from the window of the railway coach, standing beside the tracks in the hobo camp. And he imagined Annalisa Boother in the place of that strange girl. "I don't know what will become of them." His mother's mouth tightened. "I don't think it is anything that should concern us. This world is a place of harsh reality, and each of us has to face it in his own way. I think we should rather consider what would be the consequences if we did not let them go." "We would lose money," said Sasha. "That is right," And if we lose money, we have to close down the mine. Which would mean that all the others would lose their jobs, not just the few that we have to fire. Then we all suffer. If we did that with everything we own, in the end we would lose everything. We would be like the rest of them. Would you prefer that? Suddenly Shasta had a new mental image. Instead of the blonde boy standing in the hobo camp, it was himself, barefoot in dusty, tattered khakis, and he could almost feel the night chill through the thin shirt and the rumble of hunger in his guts. "No," he said explosively, and then dropped his voice. "I wouldn't like that." He shivered at the persistent images her words had invoked. "Is that going to happen, Mater? Could it happen? Might we also be poor?" "We could be, Sherry. It could happen quickly and cruelly, if we're not on guard every minute. A fortune is extremely difficult to build, but very easy to destroy." "Is it going to happen?" he insisted. And he thought about the Midas touch, his yacht, and the polo ponies, and his friends at Bishop's, and the vineyards of Veltevreden. And he was afraid. "Nothing is certain." She reached across and took his hand. "That's the fun of this game of life. If it was, then it wouldn't be worth playing." "I wouldn't like to be poor," he said. "No." She said it as vehemently as he had. "It will not happen. Not if we are cunning and bold." "What you said about the trade of the world coming to a halt," Shasta said. "People no longer able to buy our diamonds." Before, those had been merely words. Now they were a dreadful possibility. "We must believe that the wheels will one day begin to turn again, one day soon, and we must play the golden rules," she said. "Do you remember them?" She swung the Daimler through the climbing turns, up the slope, and around the spur of the hills, so that the mine buildings disappeared behind the rock wall of the cliff. "What was the first golden rule, Shasta?" she prompted him. "Sell when everybody else is buying, and buy when everybody else is selling," he repeated. "Good. And what is happening now?" she asked. "Everybody is trying to sell." It dawned upon him, and his grin was triumphant. "He's so beautiful, and he has the sense and the instinct," she thought, as she waited for him to follow the coils of the serpent until he reached his head and discovered the fangs. His expression changed as it happened. He looked at her, crestfallen. "But, Meta, how can we buy if we haven't got the money?" he asked. She pulled to the side of the track and cut the engine, then turned to him seriously and took both his hands. "I am going to treat you as a man," she said. "What I tell you is our secret, our private business that we share with nobody. Not Grandpater or Anna or Abraham Abrahams or Twentyman Jones. It's our thing, yours and mine alone." He nodded, and she drew a deep breath. "I have a premonition that this catastrophe that has engulfed the world is our pivot, an opportunity that very few are ever offered. For the last few years, I have been preparing to exploit it." "How did I do that, Sherry?" He shook his head, staring at her, fascinated. "I have turned everything, with the exception of the mine and Veltevreden, into cash. And even on those, I have borrowed heavily, very heavily." "That's why you called all the loans," he said. "That's why we went to Olvis for that fish factory and the trawlers. You wanted the money." "Yes, Sherry, yes." She encouraged him, unconsciously shaking hands, willing him to see it. And his face lit again. "You are going to buy," he exclaimed. "I have already begun," she told him. I have bought land and mining concessions, fishing concessions and guano concessions, buildings. I have even bought the Alhambra Theatre in Cape Town and the Colosseum in Johannesburg. But most of all, I have bought land, and the option to buy more land, tens and hundreds of thousands of acres, Sherry, at 2 shillings an acre. Land is the only true store of wealth.